and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by the explorer and survivalist Ed Stafford. In 2010, Ed became the first person ever to walk the entire length of the Amazon River, a feat that took 860 days and really put him on the map as one of our most prominent and exciting adventurers. From there, he's gone on to present and self-film more massive challenges, like living in complete isolation on a desert island for 60 days without food, clothes, or equipment, and being left for dead in various extreme environments around the world, from Madagascar to Mongolia. These all became incredible TV series that I've watched religiously with my husband, and I couldn't recommend more. So Ed is someone I've wanted to interview from the very beginning, but like so many of my dream guests, he's normally always traveling. So I was really lucky to finally get this time to speak with him. And I hope you enjoy what I think is a really raw and honest account of the spiritual and emotional development that comes with travel, as well as hearing about some inspiring destinations along the way. Ed Stafford, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for coming on. How are you today?
I'm very well, Holly. I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. All the better for finally getting some time in the diary to speak to you. I mean, as someone who travels so much for work, it's been hard to pin you down. But how has it been, lockdown, when you're traveling normally so frequently?
Do you know what? I've really enjoyed it, and I don't want to sound flippant, and I know what an unsettling it's been for many people, and what a difficult time, and loads of people have lost people, and I know all of the pain that goes in hand with it. But we're lucky enough to be in a little village in Leicestershire, and it's a little bit of a cliche, but the family time has just been extraordinary. You know, I've played more poo sticks than I could have possibly imagined was possible playing with my little boy, and it's been magical. My wife's going to give birth to twin girls in about 6 weeks, and so just having the time at home to be able to support her through the pregnancy and stuff like that has been amazing as well.
Congratulations.
We can't afford the bills or anything like that, but you know, fingers crossed the TV industry will pick up again soon. But you know, it's been magical. I've really enjoyed it, and you know, it's weirdly it's given time to reflect and given time to sort of appraise where you are in life and what you really want to do with everything. And I think I'm not alone in feeling that. And yeah, so I am ready for things to get back to normal now, but it's not been too bad, if I'm honest. Yeah.
I've been watching your gorgeous boy on Instagram, and he is called Ran, right?
Yeah, well, Ranulph, yeah.
Is that after Sir Ranulph Fiennes?
Well, I don't know any other ones. Ran, as in Sir Ranulph Fiennes, has been such a support over the years, and you know, when I was running out of money in the Amazon, their charity gave me money, the Transglobe Expedition Trust. And then when I came back, they made me a trustee of that trust. And so it sort of really took me under their wing. And he's always been supportive, and he's just such a legend.
He was on the podcast. He was on season one.
To him, are you?
Yeah, he was great and so inspiring.
Did he open up?
Yes, actually, I was really touched by how emotional he was, particularly when he was remembering the travels that he did with his late wife.
Yeah. I literally just emailed him actually to ask if he'll be on the first series of my new podcast as well. So
so tell me about that. That's so exciting.
Well, it's called Dangerous Minds, and it's a sort of travel podcast with a difference. So, I mean, I really want to get inside the brains of explorers who push the limits, you know, and to who suffer as well, you know, who spend months and months away from home doing something that is inherently unpleasant in order to achieve something that perhaps no one's ever done before. And I find that psychology very interesting, not because it's just impressive, but I do think a lot of those people are a little bit damaged along the way. And I find that quite intriguing as well, because I think there's, you know, I think if you're extremely balanced in life and everything's gone well from the moment you were born, you probably won't have the drive to go and, you know, walk the Amazon for 2.5 years or whatever it is. And therefore, it's just getting inside the minds of, you know, Joe Simpson and Jason Fox and Ranulph Fiennes and all sorts of people who I just really want to dig down as to why they do it, really. Yeah.
And kind of flipping it around, how if I was interviewing you for your podcast, you know, what about the psychology that got you involved in doing these extreme challenges?
I don't know, it depends how deep you want to go, really, Holly. I definitely think that walking the Amazon was something, because that was the first big thing I did. You know, I was in the military. I then led sort of gap year expeditions, which was an absolute privilege, you know, taking 18 to 24 year olds into the jungle on their gap year, giving them undeniably the best 3 months of their life. You know, they were cutting new eco trails through the jungle and washing in rivers and sleeping in hammocks. It was just the most incredible job, really, which I did for about 6 years. And then, as much as that was lovely, I got bored with pretending to be interested in who fancied who and what A-level results they were getting and all of that sort of nonsense. And and being a sort of babysitter, really, and decided I wanted to do something that I'd be able to look back on and be quite proud of. And I think, again, getting back to the psychology of the whole thing, I think growing up, I was quite insecure. I was adopted as a baby, and without this sounding like a sob story at all, I grew up with kind of a bit of a hole inside me. I felt like there was a darkness inside me. In my 20s, I'd get into trouble. I was expelled from school, all sorts of stuff like that. Wasn't particularly settled, and was quite volatile, I would say, emotionally volatile. There was something in me that needed to prove on a massive scale that I was capable, you know, that I was able to do something off my own back that would, I suppose, tell myself and tell the world that I wasn't a reject, I suppose, right. That, you know, this little abandoned baby was capable in its own right. And I think that's the deep down, I think that's the psychology that drove me to do it. I really needed to, you know, it shows the depths of the insecurity, the fact that I had to go away for 2.5 years to prove this to myself. But I genuinely think that's the case. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, had I had a proper amount of self-esteem, had I had a proper amount of confidence, there just would have been no need to do something like that, really. And so yeah, weirdly, although it's a funny old thing to talk about, I think that's probably the very, very core of what drove me to do it.
Is that something that you realised after you'd completed the Amazon and these future challenges that you've undertaken, or is it something that you knew kind of deep down all along?
No, I think it has come more recently. Yeah, I do speak about that now as if it's all very simple, but you know, there was quite a sort of egotistical reasons for starting doing it. I think, you know, many men in their 20s and early 30s and women for that matter, but maybe more men are very chest beaty, you know, they want to show off, they want to you know, shout to the world how tough they are. And you know, when I found out that nobody had ever walked the length of the Amazon, in a very sort of greedy manner, I wanted it to be me. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? How you go through life and then you get humbled massively. You know, I went from an arrogant ex-army captain to a nervous wreck who was biting his fingernails and crying himself to sleep in his hammock because he was worried that he was going to get killed by drugs traffickers or indigenous tribes or whatever. And so I think, you know, in being humbled, in being almost returned back to the, I don't know, it was like, in the military, they deliberately, at the beginning of training, give you sort of sleep deprivation phases to almost break you down before they can build you up again in a sort of version of themselves that they want to see. And I think the Amazon was almost a bit like that. You know, I started by, you know, being cocky, then I was humbled, and then slowly over months and months, I became more competent at simple things like walking over a fallen tree that was over a river without falling off and making all the other locals laugh, or you know, being able to sharpen my machete. And my confidence grew, but not just based on what other people thought of me, that sort of reflected sense of self, but actually based on what I knew I was capable of. And I think that was the really healthy thing for me. It was this little escapade that really I was able to find out really what I was made of, find out that you know, what my capabilities really were. So
Oh, well, there's a lot more that I'd like to ask you about your incredible Amazon trip, and we'll come back to that later on. But okay, Let's first of all dive into your travel diaries, starting with chapter one, and that is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Okay. Well, we used to go to a hotel called Henfais, which was in Aberdaron, which is on the north tip of Wales. I don't even know what the peninsula is called, but it was right on the very tip of Wales, and it took about 3.5 hours in the Chrysler Alpine that my dad used to have, and we all used to cram into this tiny car. It always amazes me how everyone used to cram into tiny cars back then, didn't they? Everyone's got massive SUVs now, and they've all got these big boxes on the roof, and just think, how on earth did we all get in that small car? But we did. And we used to go to Wales, and it was, you know, I didn't have an overseas holiday, I don't think, until I was in my teens or something like that. But it was always Wales, and I just loved it. You know, it was windbreaks and buckets and spades and shivering on the beach and, you know, walks in the rain and stuff like that. Such fond memories of terrible weather and you know, pretty drab scenery, quite frankly, that part of North Wales. But I don't know, for some reason, I suppose because it was family time. It was time that I'd spend most, you know, dad worked hard. He was a solicitor. Mum was a lawyer as well. This was our break. This was time to spend with both of them and with another family who were equally close. So, yeah, that was my earliest memory.
And did you have a love for the outdoors from an early age? Did you have a taste for adventure, would you say?
I think I did. Yeah, we grew up in this little village in Leicestershire and it was in the day where it was very safe to let your children just go roaming off all day. And we would literally leave at whatever it was, 9 a.m. and not come back until it was almost dark at night. And so we're building dams and tree houses and playing this game called Manhunt, which would go over several days where someone would go off and we'd all have to chase him. And I had a definite affinity to the outdoors just through that. I felt much more relaxed there than I did at school. And I think, actually, it was joining the Scouts that probably it gave me the skills that were able to turn that notch up a little bit. You know, suddenly I joined the Scouts and I was told how to administrate myself, how to pack a rucksack, how to navigate, how to, you know, look after myself, tie knots, things like that. And suddenly I thought, this is brilliant. Now I've got some skills that I can use to go further and to do more exciting things. So, yeah, it was where I lived, and it was kind of compounded by joining the Cubs and then the Scouts.
And how about chapter two, which is the first place that you fell in love with?
It's quite shabby, but we used to have this rundown caravan on the summer holidays were to Wales. And then if we were going away for weekends, it was about three times a year, probably to this place in Suffolk. And it was a shabby rundown caravan down a dusty, well, sandy track, and it was literally falling apart. And there was a little shed outside it made of asbestos that I knocked down one summer and got my lungs full of asbestos. And it was next to a pig farm, so it was really noisy. And crikey, I'm not really painting a very romantic picture of my childhood destinations, am I? But it was, memories of sitting down with my mum and reading The Twits to us by Roald Dahl and, you know, playing games at cards, canasta and that sort of stuff in this cramped little caravan, all getting bitten by mosquitoes and having these little kerosene lamps on. And it just, you know, I'm not a caravaner as an adult at all. I'm probably in the Jeremy Clarkson group of Mickey taking in regards to caravaners, but it was just this little space where you know, you had to heat up this little space for it to be toasty warm inside, and cooking on little Caligas stoves and having those little miniature boxes of cereal in the morning. Absolutely loved it. So the place that I fell in most was near Aldborough in Suffolk.
Oh, that's such a beautiful part of Suffolk, isn't it? And amazing fresh seafood that comes in to the fishmongers on the side of the road. Yeah. And it's such a great, beautiful coastline. How about camping, not caravanning?
I've always liked it. It never bothers me roughing it. You know, I'd probably sleep better on a roll mat than I do in a double bed, to be honest. And genuinely, you know, sometimes I can't sleep at night and I'll go and blow up my Thermarest and sleep on the floor.
Really?
I do. That sounds like such a stupid thing to say, doesn't it? But it's something about the overindulgence of sinking into a big luxurious bed that overcomplicates nighttime for me. There was again, I don't want to sound like a band camp broken record with the Amazon, but you know, that when I'd hit my hammock in the evenings, Cho was my Peruvian walking partner, would literally have this moment where we would both say to each other out loud, you know, no hay nada como mi hamaca, which was, there's nothing like my hammock. And and it was just, it was utterly bliss. We just literally get into our hammocks and lie there for about 5 minutes, enjoying being in our hammocks. And I think it's the simple things, isn't it? And imagine it was raining outside your hammock, and so you're in this little cocooned world where you're dry and warm and comfortable and fully supported by the hammock, and it's hammering down with rain, and you really feel like you're winning against the environment. Yeah, it's you're looking after yourself. You're not degrading. You know, you've had a wash, the clothes are, you know, clean and drying above the fire, and you've powdered your feet. And something about being able to sustain yourself for long periods of time in the wild that gives you real peace of mind, I think. Yeah.
Mm. So tell me about the route that you took. For the listeners who might not know all the details of your walk, it was 28 months walking the entire length of the Amazon River from source to sea, setting a world record and obviously putting your name on the map as one of the our great adventurers.
I read a book called Running the Amazon by Joe Kane, who was a New York journalist, and he ran the length of the Amazon from source to sea with a Czech guy called Piotr Hemilinski. And it was just fantastic journey where they got shot at with by drug traffickers with guns and by bow and arrow by indigenous tribesmen, but they were on the water, and so they were going past. So there were these fleeting glances with these incredibly hostile people. And I'm really rubbish at kayaking, but I got so hooked on this adventure book that I thought, well, what would it be like if I didn't go by boat? So I wasn't whizzing past these communities. I actually walked through every single one of them, and you know, had to look those tribal chiefs in the eye and deal with those situations head on. And that was really that sort of excitement that then stirred, and butterflies almost made me feel sick at the time. You know, it was like, but is that possible? You know, could you deal with all of those people? And, you know, I do a little bit pride myself in being able to connect with people quite well. As much as I was a 6'1" white skinhead, essentially, bumbling through the jungle, I love, you know, that's a sort of immediacy of, you know, somebody being scared of you initially, but just trying to win them around, trying to be non-threatening, trying to be, you know, not patronizing. You know, it's such a balance. You know, we were held up at arrow point and gunpoint and stuff like that on a number of occasions, and it was just, you know, reading faces and just really trying to gently ease your way through a situation without, you know, without showing that you're weak, but equally without being arrogant and overconfident and getting shot because you upset the people in front of you. So I thought that was and again, it's weird, isn't it? It's not the river crossings or the, you know, encounters with snakes and things like that. It's always been for me, the psychological aspect of it that's been the most interesting. You know, can I manage my way through these people?
What a gem.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Benny, and you crossed the infamous red zone, a no-go area in Peru known for its cocaine trafficking and its coca growing. So how was that? Was that one of the most hair-raising experiences you've had thus far, would you say?
Yeah, I was up there with Afghanistan, definitely. It was funny. Every single person said, look, if you stumble across a drugs processing plant, you'll just disappear. No one will ever hear from you again. It won't be...
Really?
It won't be spectacular. You'll just you were here and now you're not.
You'll vanish.
Yeah. And I think that could be the case. I mean, we stumbled across abandoned drugs processing plants, but luckily not active ones. And, you know, every single person that we spoke to, especially in the red zone, because no one's in the red zone unless they've got a hand in the drugs trade at some sort of level, whether they'll be growers or distributors or whatever. And everybody is only there because they're doing one thing, really. And so, and the police don't go in there, and the army don't go in there because, well, when they do, there's a big gunfight, basically. So they're kind of left to be lawless. And yeah, every single person I spoke to as we're going through were kind of laughing at me and going, look, you're gringo, you're gonna die. But yeah, it was hairy. But I think, again, just going back to just that human connection, I have a confidence in basic human kindness. And you know, just because people are opportunists and they're currently making their money out of the drugs trade doesn't mean they're inherently bad people at all, I don't think. And I think that was the case, whether that be loggers or tribesmen or coca farmers or whatever. You know, people generally, once they worked out that I wasn't a threat, they were very kind.
I studied anthropology, and so I was very envious of the opportunities you had to interact with these indigenous communities along the way. And I was just particularly interested in kind of what part certain people that you met, maybe certain individuals, played in your experience in particular. Were there any people that you met, obviously Cho being one person that you came into contact with and then ended up walking the rest of the trip with you. So yeah, I wondered if you could tell me a bit about your experience with some certain individuals.
Yeah. Well, it was actually an anthropologist who introduced me to Cho. I got to a village and they were very, very angry that I'd walked into the village. They didn't know I was coming. The village was predominantly women, which I latterly found out was because the Shining Path had... The communist guerrilla movement that was sort of prevalent in the sort of 80s and 90s had killed all of the men. But at the back of this group of women who was very, very angry and all sort of in indigenous dress and red face paint and everything, Ashanaka Indians they were, was a much taller lady, again with the same beads and face paint on, but she was clearly white. And I literally stepped towards her and held out my hand and said, are you English? And she said, yeah, hi, I'm Emily. And she just said, have you got any idea who these people are? Like, you can't just walk into this village. She'd spent 6 months as an anthropologist gaining the trust of the villagers by working in their office in a nearby town to be able to then come into the village and start studying how they live. And she just said, the concept of you turning up with your rucksack and just expecting this to be fine is ridiculous. The village didn't let me through without me going to the nearby town with Emily in order to get permits from the indigenous organization. But it was her that then introduced me to Cho. And Cho was in the nearby town. He was a forestry worker, but he also, when he ran out of money, would sort of run base cocaine up and down the mountains as well. So he was quite fascinating because he knew the dangerous areas and he knew the areas to avoid, and obviously therefore we did. But I didn't like him to begin with. He was really annoying. At the time, he was a devout evangelical Christian. Not that that's a problem, but he would sing these songs at the top of his voice, and then he'd turn around to me with this big annoying grin and say, "Are you motivated?" And like, this, having walked for sort of 5 months on my own, having this idiot keep turning around and like acting like a sort of PGL guide, I found really annoying. But then I suppose I couldn't help but acknowledge. Initially, it was quite a selfish reason why I sort of let him continue, because I couldn't help but acknowledge that he wasn't scared at all, and I was scared, and therefore he was a really positive influence on me. And so, you know, the first 5 days of walking with him became 10 days to the next town. And then at 15 days, I said, look, Cho, do you want to walk all the way to the mouth of the Amazon with me? And he said, yes. And so we literally, in a Iquitos, we had to get him a passport because he'd never left the country before and he'd never been on a plane before. We went through Manaus, which is this big metropolis in Brazil. Watching him go up an escalator for the first time in this shopping center was absolutely hilarious. So he was undeniably the rock that got me through the expedition. You know, he didn't do the first 5 months, but he did the tough bit, he did the hard bit. And he was, Ranulf Fiennes describes needing people who aren't volatile, who don't have big highs and big lows on an expedition, who are just steady. And Cho was just that. You know, he was, to my emotional volatility, to my moods and my anger outbursts, he either absorbed it or he ignored it, and he was perfect. He didn't react to it, I think, which was important. And as a result, he was the most perfect. It wasn't that he was timid or withdrawn or anything like that. He wasn't. He was a confident man. He just didn't have any need to engage in this bizarre sort of Western emotional, you know, roller coaster of emotions, which I was. He was without doubt, you know. Could I have done it without Cho? I will never know. But I think that niggle was probably the reason that I ended up going on and doing individual survival experiments. Because I think the one thing I hadn't proved to myself is that I could do this on my own, because Cho had been so supportive. Yeah.
Well, that might lead me on quite well to chapter three, which is the place where you learn the most.
Segue there, yeah.
Yeah, great segue. Thank you. Yeah, the place where you learn the most about yourself. Where would that be?
Dun, dun, dun. Olerua, which was a tiny little island, which took about an hour to walk around, conical rainforest-covered island between Fiji and Tonga in the Pacific Ocean. And the challenge was, could I be dropped off on that island with nothing and survive 60 days? But it wasn't just nothing. It really was absolutely nothing. I didn't have any water, didn't have any food, didn't have a knife, didn't have a tent of any description, didn't even have any clothes, and so was dropped off naked. And it was at a time when that was quite a big thing, you know. Naked survival has been a bit of a cliche over the last decade, but at the time it was new. And you know, they said, could you do it? And I literally just laughed and said, I haven't got a clue. I mean, I've never lit a fire with two sticks before. You know, the whole of the Amazon I used a lighter, you know, and why wouldn't you? And so it was a massive challenge. The island was quite conducive to survival. You know, there were coconuts, there were snails, there were crabs. There was a tiny bit of fresh water, which was a bit of an issue, but it wasn't, I wasn't going to have to be a rocket scientist to survive. But I think the thing that I had grossly underestimated was the effect of isolation on me. And so that's why it was definitely the thing that had the biggest impact on me. I think in terms of self-awareness, I was on this knife edge of essentially losing the plot. You know, every single thought internalized, not having anybody to bounce ideas off or to cry with or to put an arm around you or to laugh with. And I was just, I'd think to myself, like, if I wake up tomorrow a little bit more crazy than I did today, or having lost it a little bit, because there's no yardstick, you know, there's no one to compare yourself with.
No.
Then at the end of 60 days, I could be properly crazy without even realizing it, because there's no one to compare myself with. And there was all sorts of little sort of things that suggested that I might be slightly finding it difficult. And I literally from a sort of self-discovery phase, it was great looking back on it. It was the most amazing thing I've ever done in terms of I'm so much more self-aware as a result of that than I was at the beginning. But it was a really uncomfortably intense time for me. I think there were a lot of people who, if they are together, and maybe they've got no childhood issues or whatever, they could sit on an island and they could be quite composed and they could literally just go about the practical things that they need to do every day in order to survive. But I remember being dropped off by the Fijian clan, and as the boat disappeared into the ocean, I literally just wanted to vomit on the beach. I was scared. I thought it would take me like 3 weeks to start getting lonely or something. But the enormity of literally having to be 100% responsible for myself, you know, in terms of food, in terms of water, in terms of everything, was kind of overwhelming.
I watched it back last night, actually, that first night. Yeah, and it really kicked in almost instantly, that those waves of anxiety, and you seemed quite surprised by it.
It just smacked me in the face. I think what I hadn't recognised, and I was at the time a real layman in terms of psychology. I'd never had periods of depression, well, not official ones, and I'd certainly never had antidepressants or anything like that, or any type of therapy. And yet I was going into something that was so intensive that it was massively having an effect on my what I would now call mental health. I latterly I think I've sort of come to the conclusion that pre that I was I'd got myself into a thing that I think a lot of people do to a lesser degree. My concept of self was based on a reflected sense of self. So you imagine if you go into a room and you tell a joke and everyone laughs at it, you know that you're funny because everyone laughs at it. Or if you walk the Amazon and everyone tells you you're tough, then you're tough because everyone's told you that you're tough. And
yeah.
But if you go on an island on your own, there's nobody to give you any feedback at all. And part of, I think, that initial breakdown was just who the fuck am I? You know, who? Yeah. I haven't got a clue. Without any
so
feedback.
So exposing.
Unquestionably vulnerable. I mean, it wasn't helped by the fact I was naked, and I hate willy waivers as well. Like, there was just the most uncomfortable. I just wanted to put some clothes on, and, you know, yeah. But also the vulnerability of, you know, having to record this whole thing for Discovery Channel, which is going to be seen by millions of people, while having a mini identity crisis, and well, not even a mini identity crisis. I just literally had to sit down on days and go, well, okay, if you don't know who you are, then let's decide who you are. And, you know, what do you stand for? What are your morals? You know, do you want to be somebody who's honest, or do you want, you know, are you happy with stealing things, or are you happy with cheating, or are you happy with you know, and literally built up this sort of code for myself that I decided that I was happy with. And then I'd say well, okay, that's me then, isn't it? You know, if that's what you want to be, and that, you know, I want to be reliable, I want to be emotionally balanced, I want to be a good dad, I want to be this and that and the other.
And we're talking about all of these kind of serious issues that emerged, or heavy issues that emerged during your time on this kind of exquisite desert island in between Fiji and Tonga. I kind of wondered, when you were there, were you so head in the game, or did you kind of take a step back to enjoy being on a tropical deserted island? I wonder, how was the experience of the environment for you?
I tried to enjoy it, but I don't think I succeeded very many times. You know, there were fleeting moments of, it was when I was doing something which I knew was practically progressing me, but wasn't stressful. So, for example, plaiting palm leaves in order to thatch the shelter that I was building, I would suddenly have little epiphanies and waves of complete relaxation. But it was interesting because I couldn't do that while I was just sitting doing nothing, because I was scared of not progressing, of not getting stuff done. So I made myself incredibly busy. I would have little schedules and, like, give myself little 5-minute breaks every hour to have a lemon leaf tea once I'd got a fire going and stuff like this. And then I'd go straight back to work, and I'd work like a dog. And I think it was very difficult to sit and watch a sunset and go, oh, that's a beautiful sunset. I think, you know, a lot of people have postulated that if you can't share things, they're not as pretty. You know, if you look at a sunset,
yeah,
and you're not with anybody, you're not sharing that, it's harder to appreciate the beauty of it. But I was kind of making it up as I went along, really.
Hotels in the UK are opening up again, and I think we all need a break. So if you are planning a staycation, or you're visiting England and you've heard about how beautiful the villages in the Cotswolds are, I can think of no better place to recommend to you to stay than a true British classic, the Lygon Arms. The Lygon Arms is a spectacular 16th century coaching inn that's been transformed into a luxury hotel. It's steeped in history. You can even stay in a suite that Oliver Cromwell slept in the night before the Battles of Worcester in 1651. Incredible. and it stands majestically in the very heart of Broadway, which is one of the most charming, pretty villages in the Cotswolds, with a ton of boutique shops and a thriving foodie scene. And don't forget to eat also at the Ligon Bar and Grill at the hotel itself. I once had a lovely lunch there with all the finest locally sourced ingredients, and it's in the most picturesque setting. So head over to ligonarmshotel.co.uk to find out more, and I hope you have a lovely stay there. Now let's get back to Ed. From one desert island to chapter four, which is your all-time favourite destination, where would that be?
I think it's got to be Argentine Patagonia, actually. I was very fortunate enough to take a job leading expeditions down in Patagonia. There were conservation expeditions, so we were doing everything from tracking wild boar to monitoring Andean condors in the foothills of the Andes to putting out multiple day treks across the northern ice cap in Chile. And so it was magical. Obviously you've got the Andes there, you've got snow-capped mountains, you've got ski resorts, you've got stunning lakes that look like, you know, the most beautiful parts of Switzerland. All of the architecture is, you know, when they, again, quite Swiss in its influence, but, and it was quite, it did feel very European down there. And you know, the architecture was trees that haven't been sort of squared off. Everything was built with the actual shape of the trees still very, very visible. And I find that absolutely beautiful. And the people were just, you know, they'd been through this incredible financial crisis about 8 years before, where the Argentine peso was worth absolutely nothing and had to be revalued and everything. And so they're very used to the sort of barter system, but also they'd been hugely humbled by that. So you've got quite a proud nation who are proud of their sport and their rugby, which I love, but also incredibly self-deprecating because they've been humbled by this financial crisis, and they've all ended up essentially nobody had any money of note, really, apart from the guys who are international moving in. And I just absolutely fell in love with the place. Beautiful women, funny blokes, good sense of humour. They love their sport and stunning setting as well. So if there was somewhere where potentially I would love to retire to when everything calms down, it would be, Bariloche, San Carlos de Bariloche in Argentine Patagonia.
Oh, it's an area that I'd love to visit. So chapter five is your hidden gem. Tell me about a place. I mean, you've been to so many remote filming locations. I imagine you have quite a few.
Yeah, I'm ridiculously lucky in the fact that I get to go to all these amazing places. I don't profess to know any of the countries terribly well, because you end up in this little filming bubble where you're whisked from the airport to this sort of base camp area that's been set up in a load of tents, and then go into this filming bubble, sort of survival bubble, where you're operating within a very sort of constrained area for safety reasons, really. I think if there was one of those where I've had the most magical time, which is a hidden gem, it's up in the northern part of Thailand in what they call the Golden Triangle, so bordering Burma and Laos. And I think there's something about the energy up there. The people are just incredibly, incredibly kind and friendly. But I remember doing an episode of Marooned, actually, and I'd struggled mentally. Before doing this episode, I'd had to take 3 months off work for a sort of mini breakdown, which was post the 60-day survival on the island. And I remember going to Thailand quite prepared in terms of a sort of mental health toolkit. I was meditating. I was using the Headspace app. I was in quite a good place, because I think invariably, you know, there's that cliche, isn't it? Break down or break through. And it was a sort of new chapter of the next phase of my life. You know, when I you almost sometimes need to fall apart before you can put yourself back together in a better way than you know you were before. And I remember that episode was just, it had everything. It had hailstorms, it had thunderstorms, it had, you know, I was catching little frogs in the river that kept squidging out of my hand and going away. So it had sort of comedy moments. It was so bountiful. I caught a jungle chicken, and there was like lemongrass and stuff. So I made a little Thai chicken curry in a bamboo tube. And I made a cigar out of bamboo leaves. not bamboo leaves, banana leaves. And, you know, just remembering this last night, never really achieving that, you know, the aim of those marooned episodes was to thrive, or see if I could thrive in 10 days. And most of the time I was scrabbling around starving and not even remotely getting close to thriving. But I remember just sitting on this hill waiting for the helicopter to arrive, eating Thai curry, smoking a cigar, watching the sun go down, going, if this isn't thriving, I don't know what is. You know, this is where I've smashed it. So I think possibly for the fact that the area was so kind to me, that's my hidden gem, is northern Thailand.
Mm. In contrast, then, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
Mm. Do you know what I'm going to say? Ibiza. we went to. Oh, I've been a couple of times. When I got back from the Amazon, my mate George convinced me to go to Ibiza with him, and I didn't really have any money at the time, but it was grossly too expensive. So you know, when you slightly begrudge coming along, and then it just cost a fortune. I couldn't stand the sort of pretentiousness, the need to be so beautiful and wear expensive sunglasses and shorts and this. It was the exact opposite of what I thought sort of matters in life, in terms of values and not really caring about your appearance and stuff like that. And so as much as it is a beautiful island, and my wife and I have been back recently as well, more recently, I don't like trying that hard, you know, and feeling an environment where everyone is trying so hard. it wasn't for me. Too cool for school, as far as I'm concerned.
You're more low-key?
Yeah, I'm more jeans and a scruffy T-shirt rather than, I've probably got baby sick down my front half the day and, you know, chainsaw oil on my trousers. And not that the island isn't wonderful, not that there aren't amazing Ibizans, not that everyone who goes to Ibiza is an idiot, but it was just too trying to be cool, I thought, yeah.
Chapter 7, then, is your next big adventure, although the caveat now is it's your next big adventure when lockdown is over. Are there kind of any world's first challenges out there that are on your radar? What's next coming up for you?
Well, the immediate next adventure is having twin girls. That is going to take over for a little while, obviously. So that's going to take over quite a lot. The TV side of things, is kind of on hold at the moment. The boring truth is that there is no advertising revenue at the moment, and so the channels don't have the money that they need to have to commission the program. So whether that bounces back, I'm not sure. There's some fantastic series that have been postponed till next year, which fingers crossed will happen next year. One of them is Living with Gypsies for 60 Days. I think there's a huge discrimination story around gypsies. I think they're one of the last sections of society where it's pretty much acceptable to be racist against. Certainly I live in a little middle-class village in Leicestershire, and every time I've said that I'm going to go and spend 60 days with gypsies, well, you can imagine the sort of responses. They're very, very prejudiced and very racist as well. And so that will be fascinating. And I think, you know, I love the survival, I love the adventure, and I love the overseas travel, but I also really like the filmmaking side of things, and to have the privilege of tackling a really meaty subject like year before last, homelessness and sleeping on the streets of London, Glasgow and Manchester for 60 days it's weird to say that it was a privilege, but it really was. It was such an insight into a world that previously I'd known nothing about, and I really got a kick out of tackling a sort of adult subject rather than, you know, adventure, let's face it, is quite a light topic, really, isn't it? And can he get a fire going, can he not get a fire going, who really cares? And it was tackling a hard-hitting subject like homelessness, and obviously gypsies is something that I think needs addressing. That for me is a very new challenge, and I think I've never wanted to fall into the cliche of, just because I've done one world first expedition, having to do world first expeditions for the rest of my life. That just seems too obvious, really. It's like, okay, you know that if you were to go and walk the, for example, I registered walkingthenile.com before Lev Wood walked the Nile, and yet it seemed too much of a cliche to just go and walk the next river, you know. And I think in the same vein, I'd like to think that adventures don't just come by putting a rucksack on and walking and suffering. I think adventures come by starting businesses, and I think adventures come by, you know, tackling issues and stuff like homelessness and prejudice against gypsies and travellers and stuff like that.
Sure. There are so many interesting opportunities, and I guess maybe one day in the future, if the right one came along, you might consider it, or if not, as the case may be, you've got a growing family.
Well, potentially, that's the thing. I mean, when Ran was, crikey, when Rowan was about a year old, and Laura went off and did a world first expedition to kayak down the Essequibo River in Guyana. While she was away, I came up with this concept of walking across Antarctica from coast to coast. It was about 6 months after Henry Worsley sadly died trying to achieve the same thing, and he died of sort of multiple organ failure on day 72 or something like that. And I remember looking at that expedition and thinking, look, evaluating it and going, I reckon I could do that. And I think it was because Laura was away that I was thinking a little bit more like a single man. But the honest truth was, as soon as she came back, I don't want to sound like a sort of henpecked husband here, but I just thought, just from a priorities standpoint, I just don't think it's the right thing to do. There's limits, isn't there? And for me, anyway, you know, a sort of 3 months trip of that sort of magnitude and that kind of risk in Antarctica is probably one step too far at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it might not be walking Antarctica, but chapter 8 is what's at the top of your travel bucket list. Is there a place that you'd like to visit that you've not yet been to?
It is, unfortunately, Antarctica.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, definitely it is. I mean, there's a romanticism. And weirdly, I think that I'd feel almost the same about an ocean row as well. That concept of having your little tent, having your little stove, keeping your systems going. And I'm a geek in terms of the sort of having really, really efficient systems of cooking or purifying water, or, you know, putting your tent up and taking it down, or melting snow water or whatever it be in the oceans as well. But to have your little contained world where you've got to manage yourself through this, it does still appeal. And, you know, the Amazon had it to some extent, but I think I would get huge amounts on a personal level from either, I suppose, a polar journey across Antarctica or an ocean row. I think both of them would sort of tick that box in terms of that sort of cocooned little introspective world where you've just got to be as efficient as you possibly can to get from A to B.
So Antarctica, sometime in the future.
Never say never. Yeah.
Never say never. Well, thank you so much, Ed. Those were your travel diaries. Thank you so much for sharing such incredible stories with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Holly.
Oh, that was Ed Stafford. I really enjoyed that conversation. It just goes to show that travel is so formative for different people in different ways, doesn't it? And I'll definitely be tuning into his new podcast, Dangerous Minds, which is out now. If you liked this episode, why not subscribe and get new episodes weekly? You can do that for free on all the podcast apps like Apple, Spotify, and Castbox. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. For everything else podcast related, visit thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.